Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we open with some national news, including excerpts from Tim Walz's first speech as the running mate for Kamala Harris for president. Then we have the latest on the Lebanon travel alert, including assistance offered by Congressman Issa's office. Four candidates have declared to run for the La Mesa City Council, and we'll have details on today's show. Learn the latest in predicting wildfires and hear why covered California premiums are rising and about some subsidies that may help. El Cajon City Council has voted to put a sales tax on the ballot. Then on Destination East County, we'll tell you about some hot August events coming up, as well as some park closures in Lakeside and Ramona due to high heat in August. And finally, we'll be re-airing our interview with the author of The Dive, all about the world's deepest submarine rescue and the role that an East County rescuer had to play. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Large crowds packed a stadium in Philadelphia for the first public appearance by Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris with her newly named vice presidential pick, Minnesota Governor and five-term Congressman Tim Walz. Walz brings leadership skills, rural expertise, and Midwest common-sense values to the team. He's also shown himself to be a formidable competitor, willing to combat opponents Donald Trump and Trump's VP pick, J.D. Vance. Speaking at the rally, Walz took aim at Vance, whose book Hillbilly Elegy tries to appeal to rural voters. But Walz told the crowd,
"Like all regular people I grew up with in the heartland, J.D. studied at Yale, had his career funded by Silicon Valley billionaires, and then wrote a bestseller trashing that community. Come on! That's not what middle America is. And I gotta tell you, I can't wait to debate the guy." That is, if he's willing to get off the couch and show up. So, you see what I did there?
Vance also criticized former President Trump's record in office and the Republican nominee's criminal record, which includes convictions on 36 felonies for which Trump is awaiting sentencing, as well as charges pending on dozens more alleged crimes.
Now, Donald Trump sees the world a little differently than us. First of all, he doesn't know the first thing about service. He doesn't have time for it because he's too busy serving himself. Again and again and again, Trump weakens our economy to strengthen his own hand. He mocks our laws, he sows chaos and division, and that's to say nothing of his record as president. He froze in the face of the COVID crisis. He drove our economy into the ground, and make no mistake, violent crime was up under Donald Trump. That's not even counting the crimes he committed.
So just who is Tim Walz? Raised on a farm, he served 24 years in the National Guard, rising to the rank of Command Sergeant Major. He's also worked as a high school teacher in social studies and as a high school football coach, taking a team with 27 straight losses on to win the state championship for the first time in the school's history. Walz has championed working families and personal freedoms. As governor, he signed a bill into law assuring paid leave for workers to care for ill family members, cut taxes for working families, fought for free school lunches, lowered insulin fees to $35 for many Minnesotans, and signed the nation's first statewide protections for abortion after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. After the George Floyd murder at the hands of police shocked the nation, Walz reconvened the Minnesota legislature for special sessions on police reform. Those reforms resulted in restricting chokeholds and revamping training for officers to include de-escalation tactics, while also hiring more police officers on the streets, requiring body-worn cameras, and creating a special independent unit to investigate fatal police encounters. Trump this week has slammed Walz's handling of matters amid riots after the George Floyd murder. But at the time, Trump praised Walz's actions, telling reporters, "I fully agree with the way he handled it." Governor Walz has a history of winning in conservative districts, including being reelected 5 times to Congress. He served on the Veterans Affairs, Agriculture, and Armed Services Committees, championing causes for veterans and farmers. He was the lead House sponsor of the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act. He voted against bills to bail out big banks, supported the Affordable Care Act, and voted for the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act stimulus bill to invest in public infrastructure and jobs. He backed the Enhancing Small Business Research and Innovation Act, but he also drew strong approval ratings from labor unions. He has signed a bill protecting workers against wage theft and walked a picket line with auto workers. Trump has tried to denigrate Walz as an extreme liberal, though Walz was actually named the 7th most bipartisan member of Congress by the Bipartisan Index. A hunter who owns guns, Walz was actually backed by the National Rifle Association, or NRA, for his support of gun rights in several campaigns. But after the Parkland High School massacre, he donated his NRA contributions to the Intrepid Fallen Heroes Fund and denounced the NRA for refusing to support sensible gun regulations. Later, as governor, he signed into law a bill establishing universal background checks to buy guns, as well as red flag laws. He has taken a middle ground on the Israel-Hamas conflict, condemning Hamas's October 7th attacks in Israel, but also calling the war in Gaza a humanitarian crisis and supporting a ceasefire. Born in West Point, Nebraska, he grew up on his family's farm and joined the Army National Guard at just 17. He served for 24 years. Trained in heavy artillery, he suffered hearing loss as a result. After corrective surgery, he advocated for health care coverage for all Americans. While in the National Guard, he worked in disaster response after floods and tornadoes, also deploying overseas. Post 9/11, he was deployed to Europe to support Operation Enduring Freedom, receiving the Army Commendation Medal and Army Achievement Medals. He married a teacher, and they moved to her home state, Minnesota. After obtaining his teaching degree and a master's, he taught social studies and coached football. He was named most inspirational teacher at the school in a vote by students. When a gay student approached him to ask for help, he agreed to be the faculty sponsor for an LGBTQ club on campus. He has supported marriage equality and signed a bill as governor that banned forced conversion therapy. One blight on his overall honorable record occurred in 1995, when Walz was arrested for driving under the influence of alcohol and pleaded guilty to a reduced charge of reckless driving. As a result, he stopped drinking alcohol and has reportedly been sober for the last 30 years. Tim and Gwen Walz have 2 children, Hope and Gus. Hope was conceived through in vitro fertilization after the couple struggled with fertility challenges. Governor Walz, at his first rally with Vice President Harris in Philadelphia, reinforced his strong belief that women should have the freedom and the right to make their own reproductive health choices, and said those seeking to restrict those freedoms should mind their own business. Walz has taken offense at Vance's derogatory comments about childless cat ladies that became an internet meme. It's worth noting that the Walz family owns both a cat and a dog. As Harris and Walz hold a barnstorming tour across America's heartland with numerous appearances to enthusiastic crowds packing each venue, they're also outpacing the Trump-Vance team in fundraising. Trump has held far fewer campaign events recently with much smaller crowds, while he awaits sentencing in September on felony fraud convictions. Several new polls show Harris leading Trump in some, though not all, swing states. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
The U.S. State Department has issued a Level 4 advisory urging Americans not to travel to Lebanon. and for Americans in southern Lebanon, near the Syrian border, or in refugee settlements, to immediately depart. Those who do not leave should be prepared to shelter in place for a prolonged period due to escalating military actions between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. After Hezbollah strikes in Israel, Israel launched an airstrike that killed a Hezbollah leader in Beirut. Hezbollah has vowed to retaliate. Hours later, a Hamas leader was killed by a bomb in Iran. Iran has blamed Israel and threatens to attack Israel in response, though Israel has not confirmed nor denied responsibility for the killing in Iran. Any attacks on Israel are expected to trigger a wider military response. On Thursday, Israeli fighter jets reportedly flew low over Beirut, producing sonic booms that scattered frightened residents, according to Reuters. For travelers and foreign nationals in Beirut, fleeing is becoming more difficult. Insurance companies have raised premiums due to unrest in the region, prompting Air France, Lufthansa, and other European airlines to halt flights into Beirut, NPR reported yesterday. Middle East Airlines is still flying, but there are not enough planes to accommodate all who seek to leave. There are fears that the Beirut airport could be targeted, since Israel bombed the airport during a 2006 air and sea blockade. A British newspaper reported that Hezbollah has recently stockpiled missiles at the airport, though the Lebanese government denies this, and Western diplomats who toured the site reportedly saw no evidence of missiles stored there. San Diego Congressman Daryl Issa, who is of Lebanese descent, is providing the following guidance for Americans and Americans with family members in Lebanon. Staffers in ICE's office and other members of Congress can help with the process of obtaining passports or visas. Americans in Lebanon, or those here in the U.S. who want to be kept informed, can sign up for the State Department's Smart Traveler Enrollment Program to receive updated travel messages on Lebanon. The State Department advises people leaving Lebanon to avoid flying through Iran, Syria, or other countries with Level 4 alerts. Individuals who wish to depart should avail themselves of ticket options that do not necessarily take them to their preferred destination as the first stop. Rescue groups have arrived in Lebanon to assist stranded Americans and foreign nationals there. These include the Gray Bull Rescue Foundation, led by Brian Stern, a U.S. Army veteran and Navy Reserve officer, NPR reports. Stern previously led Project Dynamo, an organization that reportedly chartered aircraft and evacuated 7,000 U.S. citizens worldwide from conflict zones, including Afghanistan, Sudan, Haiti, and Israel, when the U.S. government was unable to do so. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
La Mesa's City Council will have two new members after the November election. That's because Councilman Jack Shue is stepping down due to term limits, and Councilman Colin Parent, whose term also expires, is running for State Assembly. Both Parent and Shue have endorsed two Democrats running for the council seats, Genevieve Suzuki, an attorney, journalist, and community volunteer, and Lauren Cazares, a policy advisor at San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce. The County Democratic Party and prominent Democratic officials have also endorsed both Suzuki and Cazares. The County Republican Party has not endorsed any candidate in this race. Two other candidates have pulled papers to run, fitness company CEO Sean Townsend, an independent, and Jose Fernandez, whose information is not yet available. Suzuki has practiced law in La Mesa for 10 years and now leads a law firm in San Diego. She was named a rising star by Super Lawyers, one of San Diego's top young attorneys by the San Diego Daily Transcript, and one of San Diego Metro Magazine's top 40 under 40. She received her law degree from Cal Western School of Law in San Diego. Suzuki was formerly editor-in-chief of the La Mesa Courier newspaper. She holds a journalism degree from the University of Hawaii and is co-editor of San Diego Lawyer Magazine, a publication of the County Bar Association. She and her husband Derek have lived in La Mesa for 15 years. If elected, she'd be the first Asian American Pacific Islander woman on the council. She has also been an active community volunteer, serving more than a decade on the City of La Mesa Community Services Commission, on the Board of Directors for the La Mesa Park and Recreation Foundation, and president of the parent-teacher group at St. Martin Tours Academy, where she is a parish member and her two children have been students. Suzuki calls La Mesa a fabulous community with a unique identity. She says she is running to do more to make the city safe, prosperous, and welcoming for families, workers, and small business owners. Lauren Cazares, as policy advisor of the San Diego Regional Chamber of Commerce, specializes in environment and sustainability, as well as education and workforce, small business, and economic development. She has volunteered to serve on the La Mesa Community Police Oversight Board, San Diego Community Power Advisory Committee as La Mesa's representative, San Diego Leadership Alliance, and the League of Women Voters, MTS Community Advisory Committee, and more. Daughter of small business owners and granddaughter of Latino immigrants, her passion for politics began in her youth. Later, her political experience included working for San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria as Director of Scheduling and Administration and as his campaign manager and fundraiser. She holds a bachelor's degree in political science and women's studies from Point Loma Nazarene College, where she graduated cum laude and has worked toward equality for students and faculty. If elected, she would be the first openly LGBTQ+ member of the La Mesa City Council. She also has a background in arts and sports, including dance, theater, and soccer. Cazares says, "As a lifelong La Mesan, I am committed to the quality of life for all La Mesa residents by enhancing public safety, keeping our city clean, and promoting smart growth to ensure that all local business can flourish and working families can enjoy all that our beautiful city has to offer," adding that she wants to make the jewel of the hills sparkle. Sean Townsend is the CEO of Reflection Training Gear and a former clinical exercise physiologist at Nellis Air Force Base, according to his Facebook page. He has also worked as a fitness instructor at the Navy Base in San Diego, at the Navy SEAL Base, and at private fitness companies. He studied psychology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, as well as sports and exercise science at San Diego State University. As a city council member, Townsend says he would strive to promote policies that encourage healthy lifestyles, support local businesses, and enhance the quality of life for all residents. His priorities would include fiscal responsibility, transparency, and collaboration to ensure La Mesa thrives for generations. Townsend says, since making the decision to run for office 2 years ago, he's incorporated his campaign into his training for the 2023 Triple Crown, as he puts it, a challenging series of 3 half marathons. As a result, he says, "In less than a year, I had the privilege of running on every street in La Mesa, gaining first-hand knowledge of the city's infrastructure, neighborhoods, and landmarks. Along the way, I engaged with residents, business owners, and community leaders, listening to their concerns and aspirations. This experience reinforced my belief that I can make a positive impact on our city. My passion for fitness and commitment to community service has always been intertwined," he says. "As a personal trainer, I have had the opportunity to help countless individuals achieve their health and wellness goals." And, he says, this experience has taught him the importance of setting realistic objectives, developing tailored plans, and providing unwavering support. He adds, "I believe these same principles can be applied to addressing the challenges and opportunities facing our city." Jose Fernandez has pulled papers to run, according to the city's website, but it's not yet confirmed if he's qualified for the ballot. He has no website and has not yet returned a message left on his phone. Jose Fernandez has previously pulled papers to run in La Mesa, but later withdrew from the race. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery with a report from Earth Talk on progress made in predicting wildfires. In recent years, wildfire incidents have intensified, driven by factors including climate change, land use patterns, and increasingly unpredictable weather patterns. As we grapple with the growing risk, efforts to enhance predictive capabilities and mitigate the impact of wildfires have become paramount. Predicting when and where wildfires will occur demands a sophisticated approach that integrates advanced technology with comprehensive data analysis. Indeed, researchers are leveraging cutting-edge satellite imagery and machine learning algorithms to enhance wildfire prediction models. These technologies allow experts to analyze historical fire data, vegetation patterns, weather trends, and terrains in unprecedented detail. By identifying high-risk areas and predicting potential fire behavior, scientists can provide early warnings to at-risk communities and allocate firefighting resources more effectively. Increased wildfires have also spurred new mitigation strategies. The Wilderness Society stresses three key approaches to reduce wildfire impacts. The first is proactive forest management, such as controlled burns and selective thinning of vegetation. Then there's community preparedness, including educating residents about fire safety, setting evacuation plans, and increasing firefighting infrastructure. And finally, policy reforms, such as stricter building codes and incentivized sustainable land management practices. The federal government is also ramping up initiatives. One is the Technology to Reduce the Impact of Wildfires initiative, where federal agencies work together to develop innovative tools like fire-resistant materials, advanced firefighting equipment, and real-time communication systems. This not only enhances firefighter safety, but also improves response times and coordination during wildfires. Private industry is also getting in on the act. One company, Blue Sky Analytics, uses a network of sensors with AI and machine learning to beef up ability to predict and prevent fires. Drones with infrared cameras can detect hot spots and monitor fire progression in real time, providing critical data. Sensors deployed across vulnerable landscapes continuously collect data, feeding into models that forecast fire behavior based on current conditions. Such advancements enable authorities to issue timely alerts and deploy resources where they are most needed. Combining these public and private initiatives with the power of citizen science can make all the difference as to whether fire mitigation succeeds or fails. By integrating field observations with scientific data, experts gain a more comprehensive understanding of wildfire dynamics and the impacts.
Covered California announced Wednesday that the average premium for plans on the marketplace will rise 7.9% in 2025, but subsidies are expected to blunt the impact and even lower costs for many consumers. The Biden-Harris administration's Inflation Reduction Act caps premiums at 8.5% of income for many and goes even further for those with low incomes. Rachel Lynn Gish with the nonprofit Health Access California says the state has put the federal funds to good use.
Because of this financial help, California has been able to take even further steps to lower costs for many Cover California enrollees by eliminating deductibles and reducing copays for many health services, such as doctor's visits, lab work, generic drugs.
However, the enhanced premium subsidies in the IRA will expire next year, sending costs soaring unless Congress extends them. If not, Gish expects premiums to rise 60% to 80%, costing thousands more per year. Opponents of the extension cite the need to limit federal spending. Gish says if the federal premium help ends, people could also start seeing much higher deductibles.
Without the federal assistance, California stands to lose $1.7 billion in assistance, which the state can only backfill a fraction of, which means consumers could again see deductibles as high as $5,000 or more.
Other big changes are on the way. Starting November 1st, about 40,000 income-eligible DACA recipients in California will be able to apply for premium subsidies through Covered California. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
El Cajon's City Council has unanimously voted to put a half-cent sales tax extension on the November 5th ballot. If approved by voters, the measure would continue a half-cent tax that is set to otherwise expire. The tax has generated more than $13 million annually for El Cajon's general fund, and at least 75% of these funds support the city's public safety operations. If voters choose to pass Measure J continuing this sales tax, significant budget cuts would be avoided, including but not limited to essential services such as firefighters and paramedics, police officers, street maintenance including pothole repair and repaving, and maintaining stormwater and sewage systems. When comparing El Cajon to other San Diego cities, El Cajon receives a smaller percentage of its property tax, which is not enough to sustain the community's needs. El Cajon receives 11% of its property tax earned, while Carlsbad gets 29%, according to Councilman Steve Goebel. Over the last two decades, City Manager Graham Mitchell says residents' demands have increased due to enormous expenditures on new unforeseen issues such as rising homelessness. Mitchell says El Cajon is the leanest-run city in San Diego County, adding, "We also know we have to be lean because we get less property tax than everyone else." Residents' comments from four recent town hall meetings on the issue help city staff prioritize areas for expenditure cuts if the ballot measure does not pass. Those include reducing personnel by at least 20 positions, eliminating several parks and rec centers, and even ending some citywide events such as America on Main Street and Hauntfest. The Measure J draft outlines two safeguards for taxpayers. One is the creation of an independent oversight committee, which would include a mix of residents, business representatives, accounting professionals, and representation from a taxpayer protection association. This committee did not exist for the 2008 sales tax measure. If the half-cent sales tax measure is approved by voters for continuation, it would be set to expire April 1st in 2049. Deputy Mayor Phil Ortiz acknowledged, "I don't think anybody on this council relishes extending the tax," but, he added, "there are practical realities when it comes to local government." Mayor Bill Wells agreed. He reminded his constituents that when representing a public office of this size, it requires politicians to make bipartisan decisions outside of party policies, because the reality is that situations arise and force a change to this perspective, the Republican mayor said. Councilmember Gary Kendrick and City Manager Mitchell highlighted that all four East County cities have similar sales tax measures on their ballots in November, and the San Diego Taxpayers Association is endorsing three of those four, including El Cajon. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This is Miriam Raftery with this week's Destination East County. August has some amazing events for summertime fun, including the Mount Helix Food and Wine Festival, summer jams at Santee Lakes, live music at Julian Heroes Restaurant, outdoor concerts in El Cajon, sunset train rides at the historic Campo Depot, a summer twilight walk at Mission Trails Regional Park, and live music at many venues, including Sequan, featuring Low Cash and the Jacksons, and many local artists at the Hacumba Bathhouse Bazaar. You're invited to join the Mount Helix Park Association at the Mount Helix Food and Wine Festival. The fun starts Friday night, August 16th, with the Flamingo Fling sit-down dinner and swing dancing to live music by the Flyboys, followed by the main festival on Saturday, August 17th at the Mount Helix Park with the theme Palm Springs Fling, featuring food and wine sampling, art, music, and breathtaking views from atop Mount Helix. All proceeds benefit the Mount Helix Park Foundation. For tickets, visit mounthelixpark.org/festival. Santee Lakes invites you to its summer jams, performed on the deck at Lake 4. Ramona artist Ashley Norton will perform on Thursday, August 8th, followed by Summer Breeze on Friday, August 23rd, with songs reminiscent of Steely Dan, Hall & Oates, Yacht Rock, and the 70s. Then, on August 24th, Haley Peterson wraps up the month's music. All concerts run from 5 to 7 p.m. For details, visit SanteeLakes.com. You can also enjoy live music on Friday and Saturday nights through August at 6 p.m. at Julian Heroes Restaurant and Bar in Julian. Friday, August 2nd features Punk Grass. Saturday, August 6th is Jumpstart. Friday, August 6th has Haywire. Saturday, August 10th is Blue Largo. The 16th is Lucky Strikes. Saturday, August 17th, Soul Frenzy. Friday, August 23rd, Carefree Highway. And Saturday, August 24th, Jeff Berkeley. Then on Friday, August 30th is Enter the Blue Sky, and rounding it off Saturday, August 31st, Gimme Back My Wig. Find more details at julianheroes.com. El Cajon's Dinner and a Concert series continues every Friday night in August from 6 to 8 p.m. on Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon. The lineup features Stone Soul on August 2nd, Ronstadt Revival August 9th, Trejo Band August 16th, The Heroes August 23rd, and on August 30th, Billy Nation. For updates and event news, visit downtownelcajon.com. Pacific Southwest Railway Museum in Campo hosts rides aboard a historic train every Saturday and Sunday in August at several times between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. There are also special sunset train rides on Saturday nights all summer long. You can relax while the San Diego countryside rolls by during a pleasant round-trip train ride on the historic San Diego and Arizona Railway. The Golden Stays, the museum's classic weekend excursion. Depart from the Campo Depot for the approximate 45-minute ride after visiting the museum's gift shop and ticket office. For tickets and details, visit psrm.org. That's Pacific Southwest Railway Museum. Join Mission Trails Regional Park Trail Guides for a special twilight summer walk on August 17th from 7 to 9 p.m. You can learn about changes that occur at dusk as the sun goes down. Meet at the parking lot at the corner of Bushy Hill Drive and Father Newitt Brosera Trail across from Kumeyaay Lake Campground. Bring a flashlight and extra clothing since it often cools down after the sun sets. For more information, you can visit mtrp.org/events. Lokash will perform live at Sequan's River Venue on August 22nd at 8 p.m., where you can enjoy the show poolside or get a VIP cabana and float to savor the music. Named country music's iconic feel-good duo by People magazine, Lokash artists Preston Brust and Chris Lucas are known for their chart-topping hits such as I Love This Life, Feels Like a Party, and I Know Somebody. For tickets, visit sequan.com/events. And the Jacksons have been performing for 50 years, starting as the Jackson 5, vaulting to fame in Motown, and launching Michael Jackson's solo career. They've been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Recording Academy's Grammy Hall of Fame. Now the Jacksons are coming to Sequan's Heritage Event Center for a performance on August 30th at 8 p.m. Tickets are available at sequan.com/events. And finally, there are live music concerts at the Bathhouse Bazaar, sponsored by the Hukumba Hot Springs Hotel. August artists include Francis Bloom and Nate Cole, Good Gravy, Nicky Diamond and Marley Hall, Pete and Milas Molinari, Cripsotica, and Cretan Hop DJs at the Ritual Pool. You can find a full lineup at hukumba.com. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
Due to triple-digit temperatures, two county parks will be closed for the month of August. They are El Capitan County Preserve in Lakeside and Mount Gower County Park in Ramona. These locations have difficult trails that end in isolated areas. They also offer very limited shade, which can lead to dangerous conditions during major heat events. They join two desert parks that are already closed for the summer due to extreme heat, Vallecito and Agua Caliente County Parks. Brian Albright, director of the County of San Diego Department of Parks and Recreation, says, "When we close park gates, it's to reduce health risks and related injuries caused by severe weather events, for guests as well as for our own team members who are called to assist in emergency situations. The closures also provide county parks and recreation staff an opportunity to conduct needed maintenance, including trail restoration, during the early mornings or evenings while it is cooler. There are more than 100 other county parks and preserves to explore during the month of August. If you do offer a hike, be smart about it. Here are some safety tips to consider. Let someone know where you will be and when you plan to return. Hike with others, never alone. Leave your dog at home for difficult hikes. Even easy hikes might be too much for your dog when the air or ground are too hot, and dogs have died on local trails due to high heat. Take plenty of water to stay hydrated. Rangers recommend about a quart for every 2 to 3 miles. Wear sunscreen, a hat, and sunglasses. Take breaks in shade if possible. Take a fully charged mobile phone, map, and/or GPS to prevent getting lost or to help rescuers find you if you have an emergency. Wear lightweight, light-colored, ventilated clothing. Bring along a warm jacket if you plan to stay out after dusk. Wear sturdy shoes with traction for slippery rocks. Follow all posted safety rules. Bring ample food, a flashlight, first aid kit, multi-purpose tool, and a whistle. Know your limitations. Choose trails that match your level of physical fitness. For more information on county parks, visit sdparks.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, This is John Tidwell.
Next up, we're going to be re-airing one of our Best of East County episodes, our bookshelf interview with the author of The Dive, about the world's deepest submarine rescue and the role that an East County resident played in that.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment.
Today I'm speaking with author Stephen McGinty, author of the new book, The Dive, The Untold Story of the World's Deepest Submarine Rescue. My guest is also an award-winning journalist and producer of documentaries. His documentary, Fire in the Night, is based on the book of the same name and won the Audience Award at the Edinburgh International Film Festival and won Best Single Documentary. Stephen McGinty lives in Scotland. Welcome, Stephen. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
No, thank you for inviting me.
Let's begin with the story itself, the race against time that took place first to locate the Pisces III and then execute the deepest rescue in maritime history. What first sparked your interest in the topic and why write a book?
Well, I first heard about it when I was on a cruise, of all things, many years ago. I was on a cruise and I was sitting at the captain's table and he told me the story that of this incredible sequence of events that had taken place just off the coast of Ireland, well, about 150 miles off the coast of Ireland back in 1973. And I'd always been fascinated by the deep. I'd always been fascinated by oceans. And I filed it away. And I was amazed that no one had actually told a modern story about it, written a modern book. And I was looking for a new subject for a book and decided to dust it down as an idea. And when I looked at it, it's just the most incredible story. I mean, my goal was to write a nonfiction thriller, and the bare bones of the story there were great material because the story is really quite incredible.
So you didn't have to make it up. It was already there.
Well, that's the beauty of nonfiction. You know, you don't have to make it up because the characters are fantastic. I mean, to give you your listeners a kind of an idea of the situation, you know, that these guys, Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman, found themselves in. They were in a small Pisces submersible, and they eventually sank to 1,600, 1,700 feet. So, but the way I always describe it to people is try and imagine you're in a phone box, a kind of relatively large phone box with your friend, and the phone box is sitting at the bottom of the Empire State Building, and you look out of the window, and the Atlantic Ocean rolls in to a height 10 stories above the very top of the Empire State Building. Oh. Everything is pitch dark. Then you start bleeding oxygen. And then you realize that the people on the surface don't know exactly where you are, where you've sank. And when they do know where you are, either way, it's going to be 2 days at least before they can start the rescue. And then when they do start the rescue, everything goes wrong.
How did they get trapped in the first place? How did that happen?
Well, what happened was that they were doing a kind of standard job. This was 1973, and their job was to pilot the small commercial submersible, a Pisces III. And what their job was this was back in 1973 when there was the Cantac cable, which was the Canadian transatlantic telephone cable, and it ran from Britain to Canada, and it recently been laid, and this was high technology at the time. This allowed 1,700 phone calls to be made at any one time between North America and the UK. And I try and imagine that, you know, that was great. 1,700 phone calls could be made at any time.
Right.
Now, their job was, the cable had been laid, but their job was to bury it because it was sitting on the surface, and at that depth, it could still have been hauled up by any kind of deep sea fishing trawlers. So their job was to dig a small trench and to let it drop into the trench. What happened was they did an 8-hour shift. They went to the surface, and this is where it gets tragic for them and difficult to imagine today. At the time, the way that they tracked these submersibles, it was almost like Jaws, where they fired the arrow into the shark, and it was a barrel at the top. What happened was there was a kind of large flotation device that was on the top of the surface, and it was connected to a cable to the submarine, and then 2,000 feet of rope, effectively. So that's how they knew where it was. So when it got to the surface, the diver disconnected this cable So they no longer knew where it was because it was on the surface. But then what happened was there was a kind of a freak accident whereby a tow rope coiled onto the back of the submarine and it accidentally lifted up a hatch. And what then happened was a ton of water poured into the back of the submarine. And that obviously increased the weight of it, tipped it down, and it sank. First of all, it sank to 170 feet where it was caught on a tow rope. And it managed to last in the tow rope for maybe 3 or 4 minutes while they were frantically trying to sort of dump weight off the submarine. And then the tow rope snapped and the submarine fell another 1,500 feet and crash landed on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. And at that point, when they realized what happened, you know, they crash landed in the bottom, they knew they were deeper than any submarine had ever been rescued before. So they knew they both knew they were in serious trouble.
And so explain the danger.
Well, the danger is twofold. One, you're in a steel coffin, effectively. You're in a submarine, but effectively it's a very tight space. You know, it's maybe 5 feet in diameter or less. They don't know where you are on the surface. Because although you left the surface at a certain point, they don't know which direction they plummeted. They've also got a limited amount of oxygen supply. They've got roughly, if they were acting normally, they would have, and moving around the submarine as they knew it, they would have 30 hours of oxygen left. Their job was now to lie very still, not to speak, and to be very calm. And by doing that, it was estimated they could stretch that oxygen out to maybe 3 days. The problem, though, was that in order for them to be rescued at that time when they crashed, the only way to rescue them was to get other submarines onto the spot, i.e. down to where they were. The only submarines that could do that, one was in the North Sea, one was in Canada, on the east coast of Canada, and the other one, which was fantastic, was in San Diego, where the Curve team operated from. Now, Curve was high technology in 1973. It was a remote controlled submarine, a remote controlled effective submarine device. And what happened then was that there was a massive rescue operation that was launched. They were stuck on the bottom of the Atlantic. And then phone calls were made to the teams in San Diego and the teams in Canada, and everything swung into action. Massive Hercules aircraft were prepared. The teams in San Diego and the teams in Halifax, Nova Scotia, got everything together, drove at speed to the airports, put all their equipment, men, submarines, every piece of technical long ropes, and managed to get into the air as quickly as possible. So then they were flying over to Cork, where they landed. The ship that was on the surface then had to leave them after another ship had come to maintain the spot. The Vickers Voyager sailed 13 hours back to Cork, picked everyone up in Cork, got the submarines on board, then got them back to the rescue. And effectively what happened over a 25 to 36 hour period was a desperate rescue attempt, because they knew that every hour counted, every minute counted, every second counted. And these two men were running out of oxygen. And what they did was they sent down a mini submarine, first of all, to try and rescue them. The problem was the mini submarine had a rope gripped in its hand. They have these kind of talons, effectively. But the problem was the rope was too buoyant. So when it got down to about 1,000 feet, the buoyancy of the rope was too great and it ripped it out of the talon. So they don't have a rope to fix it with. They also don't know where it is. So the first mission ends in failure. The second mission goes down. The second submarine, which is the Canadians, go down. And they're down for 8 to 10 hours and they can't find it. As I've described it in the book, is they know where the haystack is. They know there's a haystack down there. They just don't know where the needle is. They just don't know where Pisces 3 is. They're trying to track it by sonar. So the first, second submarine's down for 10 hours, goes back to the surface, goes back down again. And what they try to do is they get the men to sing to try and sing so that the higher notes they might be able to pick up on sonar. So they're singing, you know, we're here, and eventually they manage to find them. So there's this very moving scene where the two men in the submarine are looking out the porthole windows because all they see is blackness and a tiny wash of crud, of bits of debris or animals that are floating past, the occasional fish. They can also hear dolphins and porpoises down there, and they interfere with the radio, the underwater telephone, as it's known. But there's an amazingly moving moment when the Canadians in their small mini submarine get closer and closer, and suddenly the light outside the submarine goes from pitch black and slowly begins to lighten and lighten and lighten, and that's when they realise they've been found.
Wow, what a story. And I'm trying to picture their response when they're asked to sing.
Well,
and,
yeah.
And if the dolphins sang
yeah, with them. Well, the thing was, although they've actually been found, the Canadians have to attach a hook to the kind of lift point in the submarine. And I've described it as like threading a needle while wearing a suit of armour. And they managed to do it. But the point is, another freak accident, no sooner is the rope with the hook attached than it rolls out and falls off. And they're scrambling to try and get the rope back on, but they can't get it onto the right point. They've connected it, but it's not to a point strong enough to lift it. And then they have to send down another sub. That doesn't work. And then the Americans, and again, there's time's running out, time's running out. So what they do is they then, the Americans finally arrive on the scene, our boys from San Diego, you know, guys like Larry Brady, Jim McFarland. Sorry, that's the Canadians. Larry Brady was the Americans from San Diego. Bob Watts, Tom Wojcicki, Denny Holstein, John DeFriest, William Sanderson, William Patterson. You're from San Diego, so I thought I'd mention all the local boys there.
Right.
But they are called in, and they arrive on the scene. And again, things going wrong, they're told to power up Curve to send it down, and there's a massive electronic sort of system that powers this thing, and they switch it on because they're about to send it down. But what they don't know is that while they've been traveling out from Cork, salt water from the sea spray and the waves has got into the circuits, and literally as soon as they flick it on, the whole thing blows. And we're at a time where every minute counts. They calculate it's going to be 4 hours for them to hand rewire all the circuit boards. And this is when everything is going wrong. But eventually the Americans get down, and after one team puts down a rope, the Americans get another one on. So it's just, yeah, it's to say that it was a roller coaster of a rescue, it does a dreadful disservice to roller coasters because it was far worse.
Right. And what was the state of the crew members?
Well, they were lucky in that Roger Mallinson, who is still alive, and I interviewed him extensively for the book, always said that he was so pleased that he was down with Roger Chapman, the Jolly Rogers, as they were known by the time they got back to shore, described by the British press. But Roger Chapman was ex-Navy, and he was a submariner, and had been on nuclear submarines before joining this commercial small submarine crew, Vickers. And Mallinson always said that he didn't think they would have survived if he'd been down with anyone else, because both of them were level-headed, and although they were terrified, they had that British stiff upper lip where they just suppressed it. They bit through the pain and frustration, but it was exceedingly difficult. Try and imagine that stress when you're in there and oxygen's bleeding out because you're using oxygen. You've also got to operate the scrubber, which takes out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and that's dependent on the batteries, and the batteries could go at any minute. And they're also, because of as carbon dioxide rises in the atmosphere, you get splitting headaches and pain in your joints. And they're also worrying about their families.
Sure.
So it was... what was fascinating about the story was that they both said, Chapman in his memoir, which he'd written a couple of years after the events of 40 odd years ago, and Mallinson in interviews with me, they both said that the worst part of the whole experience was the lift. because it took them 2.5 hours to get from the bottom to the top. And because of the way that the waves were going and the ship that they were attached to, it was like they were like a giant fish attached to a rod, and the rod kept going up and down. So the submarine itself kept battering back and forth. So they were like sardines rattled in a very violent tin.
And that part, that being the worst part, are they talking about physically or emotionally or both?
I think it was two things. It was physically because of the being battered about inside the submarine, and also the stress of it, because they didn't understand the device that was hooking them on. They thought it was a hook, like an open-ended hook. So in their head, all this shaking about meant they could fly off any second. And then it was the fact that they kept stopping. And at one point, other divers had to go down while this thing's thrashing about and fix a final line onto it. So it's a remarkable story. But for me, it's a remarkable story in that it's about the brotherhood of the sea. You know, this notion that if you are in peril in the sea, all other ships will come to your aid. Everything's put on hold. And the priority is, how do we get these men up? So we had the Canadians, you know, the amazing team from HICO coming over, like, you know, Al Trice, Mike McDonald, Jim McBeth, they all fly over. You've got the San Diego team that I've talked about, and you've also got their own team from Vickers Voyager. Because, I mean, it's a remarkable story.
The determination.
Yeah, I think it teaches you. There's a great quote I've always loved from Winston Churchill, where he said, "Never, ever, ever give in," and I think it's very true. And that's certainly what they did. Peter Messervy, who was a kind of former commander who led the rescue along with Al Trice, it was tenacity, and it was Al Trice always used to joke, "If it was easy, everyone would be doing it."
Right.
Now, he said that when he was looking at the helicopter that was supposed to bring them rope from another ship, and the helicopter had misjudged the weight of the rope. So the helicopter took off with this basket carrying all this rope underneath it. And literally, as soon as it took off, it started plummeting down towards the sea because it was dragged down by the rope, and it had to jettison the rope or else it would have crashed. So suddenly this rope they need is bobbing about on the surface of the North Sea in the midst of a storm. So that was just another thing that went wrong.
My goodness. How do you think you would respond if you were to find yourself in this kind of situation?
Yeah, I'm not sure I would have coped as well as either Chapman or Mallinson. I think we claustrophobia would have been...
That's what I was thinking, yes.
It would have been excruciating. And also that sense of panic, that also... the way your mind operates in these situations where you're constantly projecting about all the things that could go wrong, everything that had gone wrong, but then all the things that still could go wrong. So I think, if you want to imagine what it'd be like, just imagine yourself in that telephone box at the bottom of the Empire State Building and then the Atlantic Ocean rolling in. I think it would have been hard to say the least.
I can't help thinking a discipline of mind.
Well, I suppose the other thing is, we never know what we're capable of until we're in that situation.
That's true.
But the key is not to be in a small submarine that sinks.
What was it like to research this book for you?
The fascinating thing about it was I had my plan. Again, there's a great line I always love, which applies to this rescue operation as applied to the writing of the book, because there's a great, you know, the phrase, you know, how do you make God laugh? Tell him your plans. And of course, my plan was to travel over to San Diego to meet the guys, travel to Canada to interview them, to go down to the Lake District to meet Roger Mallinson and Roger Chapman's wife and widow. But of course, the pandemic kicked in and no one was going anywhere. So the entire book was conducted. All the research was done from my house, interviewing people over the phone, over Zoom. Just getting documents that I could, the original. What was great is a lot of it was based on paperwork, so it was the original report into the crash. I got access to that. Also, the teams in Canada and in America had written their own documents about it, so I was able to use a lot of those material, and also found old recordings. So in a project like this, it's all about stitching the material together. You know, you have your facts, you know the circumstance. I've always believed in three C's when it comes to projects like this. It's all about character, context, and chronology. And if you can get those three elements and lay them out and then think, how do I tell this in a way that's absolutely factually correct to the best of your ability, but will engage the reader as much as possible? How can I put the reader in the experiences of these men? It was a great story to write, and also because it's got such a happy ending, you know. I hope that even though people will read from the blurb that they survived, that when you're in the midst of it, you forget,
right?
Because that was the, I think the reason, what one of the things I wanted to push people into it was to write a lot of it in the present tense, because we know these guys didn't know that they were going to pull off this rescue massively at 3 o'clock on Saturday morning, when he knew he didn't yet have a lift line on the submarine, and they had 6 hours of oxygen left. He'd been at it for 26 hours and they hadn't got a line on it. Obviously we know that he pulled it off, but to be in that position, and he's just got a phone call from the other ship from the Americans, we're just about to send the curve down, but it's blown its fuses. There's going to be a 3 or 4 hour delay. Yeah. These are very tough situations.
Yeah, it's like dying any minute for hours.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they were doing. They were dying down there, and they managed to get them back. In fact, that was the touching thing, because again, these are all hardy men of the sea, and you know, white blue collar workers pulling together from around the world to save them. And I think it is telling that when they finally got to the surface, on the ships around them, a lot of the guys who'd been working on it were at the railings watching. And as soon as it hit the surface, people talked about how they just burst into tears.
It's a wonderful ending. One last question, kind of apart from this particular amazing story, what book or documentary are you going to work on next?
Yeah, well, I've got a new idea for a book, which I can't kind of go into all the details yet.
Okay.
To what it is, but I'm developing that. It's, again, the plan is it'll be a nonfiction thriller. You know, basically, you know, obviously, I write factual books. That's my kind of forte. But the other project that we're obviously keen to do is we're developing. The Dive has been optioned by Mark Gordon, the producer of Saving Private Ryan and Speed, and we're developing it now.
Wow.
With a great team to develop it as a film. So
yes.
I'm looking forward to helping out with that and to seeing how that all comes out.
Yes, that would be a wonderful film. Well, Stephen McGinty, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure having you on Bookshelf and hearing all about your adventure, vicarious adventure.
Yes, indeed. Tales of the Sea.
So thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
For further information on Stephen McGinty and his book, The Dive, please visit him on Twitter at SG McGinty, and that's spelled SGMCGINTY. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.